The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose Masterforce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from Masterforce today. Check out all our Masterforce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey guys, we're about to start episode 10 of season 1. This is the last episode of the season, and then we're going to take the rest of the summer off. We're going to be back at the end of September for the beginning of season 2. So right now, I just want to give a big thank you to all the listeners for your love and support. It has meant so much to me. When we launched, none of us knew exactly how this was going to go over. Like a lot of you have said, this is not a normal podcast, but because of all of you and your amazing feedback, everyone here at Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is overjoyed to be bringing this show to you and to keep doing it for as long as we can. Me, Scott, Forrest, Susan, all those names you hear at the end of the podcast, Kevin, Tommy, Kayla, Tess, and Nima, we can't express our gratitude enough. If you've been loving the show, please tell someone you know about it. That's how we're going to get to keep doing it. And you'll hear it again at the end of the episode, but keep checking the feed and checking the socials, because there's going to be a couple of big announcements coming up about bonus content and special episodes during the break, so keep an eye out. Anyway, thank you again. It has been an absolute honor and pleasure for me to be talking with you in this way, and there's a lot more coming, so anyway, on with tonight's show. Here we go. Miracles by D. Scott Rogo. Part 3. Levitation. Levitation. The rising or lifting of a person or thing as if by magic. D. Scott Rogo relates the following story in his book, Miracles, A Parascientific Inquiry into Wondrous Phenomena. In 1717, Sister Maria Villani, a Dominican nun at a small convent in Italy, experienced spontaneous levitation. She described it in a letter to her spiritual director like this, quote, "When I was in my cell, I was conscious of a new experience. I felt myself seized and ravished out of my senses, so powerfully that I found myself lifted up completely by the very soles of my feet, but with a gentleness that was marvelous and most delightful. At first, I felt much fear, but afterwards, I remained in the greatest possible contentment and joy of spirit. Though I was quite beside myself, still in spite of that, I knew that I was raised some distance above the earth. Two things happened to me on January 9th, 2002. I found out that ABC was going to shoot my Miracles pilot. And I had my first one-night stand. Hacha! It was also my last. If you came here looking for smut, you're way off, you damn perverts. Look, my sexual experience is deep, not wide. I've married half the people I've ever slept with. This particular woman's name was Rachel. She was cute and had a British accent. So did my therapist. Yeah, I know, but I'm 40% sure it was a coincidence. Was it a magical night filled with ecstasy? Well, sure for her. For me, I'm not sure. I remember I was pretty happy while it was happening. I think I was just glad it was happening. I mean, this was totally novel. It was the kind of experience that, when you're a weirdo, makes you feel like you're finally doing what normal people do all the time. The problem is, when you're a weirdo, normal things don't feel normal, they feel weird. And I was only partially there. Mostly I was sitting across the room, observing and trying to provide myself with emotional support. You're doing fine, Rich. She has no idea you're basically a virgin. See, she's into it. Wait, I can't tell if she's having an orgasm or just yawning. But the next morning, I felt bad. What had I done? What did she expect of me? We'd had sex. Did that mean we were dating now? Did I need to check on her and see if she was okay? Did I need to marry her? Yes, I know this all sounds insane, but we've established I'm insane. But all these questions felt very real and important and immediate. I felt like this was something that had to be dealt with, and if I dealt with it wrong, I was a bad person. I was just messing up people's lives right and left. My therapist suggested I wait a few days before calling Rachel. Listen, Governor, I bet don't mind if a geezer doesn't call. Gore, it's 2002, isn't it? She didn't really talk like that. I just like trotting out my flawless British accent every once in a while. Okay. At first, not calling her felt brave. But then, once I realized I didn't really like her, and would be fine never seeing her again, not calling felt cowardly. But I never called. And she never called me. So I guess that answers my question about the yawning. Megan did call. She wanted to have a meeting to go over the pilot process, next steps, and what was coming up. Spyglass had never done a pilot either, so we were both stepping into a new world. When I got to her office later that week, the first thing we did was go over a list of potential directors. I didn't know most of the people she was talking about, but that didn't stop it from being, by far, the most exciting conversation I had ever had in my career. This was because it was a conversation, not just someone telling me something. My input was not only allowed, it was welcome. Hell, it was required. And it wasn't about the script. It was about making the thing. This was totally new, and apparently totally normal. No wonder it felt so weird. This, I would learn, was the main difference between television and film. In films, once you're done writing the script, you're usually done for good. The director takes over, and if you're lucky, you'll get invited to a screening. That had been my experience with Mothman. In television, the director is not the boss, the writer is. When the script is done, you turn your hat around from writer to producer and get right to work, hiring department heads, going to casting sessions, scouting locations, covering the set, and then later, sitting with an editor, going over cuts. I didn't know any of this that day. I just knew I was so, so happy to be involved in the making of something I deeply cared about. Megan suddenly got a funny look on her face and said, "There's one more name on the list, but I'm happy to cross it out. I just thought I'd mention him because he has a deal with Touchstone. But we don't want you to work with anyone you're unhappy with." Who could it possibly be, I thought. I hadn't been in the business long enough to really hate anyone, or for anyone to hate me, unless it was Steven Seagal. "Who is it?" I asked. She said, "Matt Reeves." Matt Reeves? My best friend, Matt Reeves? My old partner at USC Film School? The guy I'd written Dark Territory with? Would I be okay with Matt directing my pilot? There was literally no other name that could have filled me with more joy. Not Spielberg, not Scorsese. But was he really available? Turns out he was. He was finishing up on Felicity. JJ had already left to do Alias. But Matt still owed ABC either a pilot script or a pilot directing gig. Doing my pilot would fulfill his contract. I asked Megan, "Why did you think I wouldn't want Matt?" She said that since we hadn't worked together since Dark Territory, she thought maybe we'd had a falling out. But the truth was, it was only a matter of circumstances that we hadn't teamed up again. He was focusing on directing and running Felicity, and I was busy ruining my marriage and going crazy. It was just bad timing. But the idea of Matt directing Miracles? I mean, he wasn't just my friend. He was an amazing director. In film school, he made my projects so much better than they had any right to be. I knew that however good the script for Miracles might be, Matt was going to elevate it through the roof in ways I could only begin to imagine. "If you can get Matt," I said, "I will be the happiest person in the world." "Oh, thank God," Megan said, "because he's our number one choice." Matt read the script over the weekend and was on board by Monday. I felt like helium had been pumped into my veins. I was fucking floating. The Mothman Prophecies opened on Friday, January 25th, 2002. I went to see it at the Arclight in Sherman Oaks with a bunch of guy friends, all of whom gave me an unrelenting amount of shit the whole time. Not to keep me from getting a big head, but actually to get all the dark shit I was thinking out of my head by verbalizing things that were even worse. What was I worried about? Well, mostly box office. The reviews had already done their damage. Most critics didn't like it. Some hated it. Roger Ebert hated it. And the ones who did like it made sure to point out that it was Mark Pellington's direction that had salvaged my preposterous, dull, hokey, hacky screenplay. My only real revenge would be a box office smash for the weekend. That didn't happen. It opened in sixth place, beaten out by other new releases like A Walk to Remember and The Count of Monte Cristo. By Monday, it was clear. The movie was performing average at best. Whatever I had hoped for wasn't going to happen. People who were close to me, friends and family, were so supportive and happy for me, but I was unable to be happy for myself. I felt terrible, like a total failure, a public failure. And I remember wishing I could just go into a chemically induced coma and wake up 3 months later when all of this was over and forgotten. As I went to sleep that night, I could hear my mother's voice reminding me, "Never take something you care about to school." The divorce process was beginning. My wife and I were meeting with a mediator rather than squaring off with separate lawyers. It was a good idea, but it didn't change the fact that this was happening. And all the sick, angry, scared feelings that were held back for the last year were surging forward. There was nothing I could do about Mothman, and I felt equally helpless facing the divorce negotiations. I could try to get myself worked up about standing up for myself, but I knew that any financial help I tried to hold back from her was really only going to hurt my kids. So it was easier for me, and less scary and confrontational, to just give in. Even if it made me feel small and resentful. I guess by then I was used to it. Miracles is what saved me. It gave me something to do, something to focus on every day. Throughout most of February, the main job was casting. This involved me, Matt, and Megan watching actors come into a conference room on the Disney lot in Burbank and watch them read scenes from my script. Any writer who's ever been lucky enough to watch actors read lines that he or she has written knows what a thrill this is. For about one day. Then it becomes excruciating. Sometime around the 15th audition for any particular role, you begin questioning why you wrote the script at all, never mind writing it so poorly. When did the words become so flat and dull, and the scenes so trite and predictable? You try to remind yourself, it's only because I'm hearing it over and over. But there's something cruel and Twilight Zone-like about the whole process. It's like having your favorite food thrown at you by an angry chimp. And whatever thrill you got by finally standing in judgment of someone instead of being the one judged vanishes when you realize how ill-equipped you are to be judging anyone. The upside to all of this is when someone comes in and nails it. It's not necessarily skill or talent, although that plays a part. It's just that sometimes someone sort of is the character, and that's that. Our first experience with this was with an actress named Phyllis Lyons, who was reading for the role of Tommy's mother. On this particular day, it was just me and Matt in the audition. Whenever it was just us, it automatically felt like college again, like we were just two kids being handed the keys to a sports car we were afraid to drive. But we knew how to behave in front of the grown-ups. We politely greeted Phyllis when she came in and settled back as she started to read. And then, about a page into it, we started to laugh. Uncontrollably. This might be the absolute worst thing you can do during an audition that isn't a comedy. And the scene Phyllis was reading was definitely not comedy. Again, she was reading for the role of Olivia Ferguson, the mother of Tommy, the little boy who can heal people, but who gets sicker and sicker every time he does. In this scene, she's having an argument with her husband that grows more and more heated. Suddenly, she started shouting, and it was so real and so scary that Matt and I, having mother issues, had no other way to react. She stopped and looked at us, and we both immediately started apologizing like crazy. Was I doing something wrong? She asked. No, we told her. She was doing it too damn right. We told her she didn't have to keep going. We loved her and we were so sorry to be such immature idiots. But it's hard to come back from something like that. And I don't think she really believed us until the next day when we cast her. And just like that first day, her performance in the pilot is brilliant. And Phyllis, if you're listening, I'm so sorry once again, and thank you for being so much more of a grown-up than me. Bit by bit and roll by roll, we filled in our cast. But the two main leads remained elusive, Paul Callan and Alva Keel. We'd read a lot of actors for the role of Paul. A lot. There were a few standouts. Scott Bairstow, who was finishing up long runs on Party of Five and Harsh Realm, was great. And Christian Camargo, who was recently a regular in the Apple Plus series C, gave an excellent performance. But Spyglass was a movie company, and after a while it became clear they wanted to cast a movie star. It was what they did. And ABC sure wasn't going to stop them. But who? The first name on their list was Skeet Ulrich. I knew who he was, and I liked him. But I couldn't necessarily see him playing the role of Paul any more than anyone else. When I watched an actor audition, I was really just listening to see whether they read the lines the way I heard them in my head. But one day, I noticed Matt watching an audition. He would slowly move his hand to his face and curl his fist into a little tunnel in front of his left eye. Later, I asked him what he was doing, and he told me he was trying to see the actor in a close-up. He wasn't really listening to their voice at all. He was trying to find something in their face, their eyes, something like a magnet that made them watchable. Matt was approaching this process in a completely different way than I was, and he'd done it before. I hadn't. I knew Matt was hugely talented. I'd known that since film school. But I was now beginning to realize that Matt was bringing a level of experience to this project that I simply did not have. In fact, over the next few months, I would have this feeling over and over with various people. I had created something that was now going to be brought to life by people who were vastly more experienced in their fields than I was in mine. This is a feeling I've carried with me throughout my career, even as over the years, I've become the one with the most experience, in many cases. But more experience doesn't mean I know more about someone's job than they do. I learned early on to value the contributions of my fellow artists in producing television. And because I felt so supported, I never felt the need to be a possessive control freak or to stand over someone and micromanage them doing their job. Now, a lot of this is because, as neurotic as I am, I'm not a narcissist. I'm just not. I swear to God, my therapist said so. Depressed and anxious, sure. But even that's going away, thank God. I've always been able to enjoy working with other people, rather than see their contributions as some sort of a threat to my autonomy. And I can't imagine the gifts I would have missed if I didn't let people do their thing without the fear of me steamrolling them into delivering my vision, whatever the fuck that might be. I can't tell you the number of times I've looked back and realized how badly I would have fucked things up if I had insisted on my way and not trusted other people who knew better or simply had a vision that was different from mine. TV is a collaborative art form. If you're not comfortable collaborating, I urge you to take up poetry or sculpture or something else that can be done in complete isolation. But in television, you can't do it all by yourself. And you can't treat other people as nothing more than physical extensions of your own ego. I mean, you can. You can try. I've seen many try. But you'll never be satisfied with the results, and you will have made your coworkers miserable in the process. What's the point of that? Life's way too short. While Spyglass pursued Skeet Ulrich for the part of Paul Callan, a name came up for the role of Alva Keel that blew my mind. Donald Sutherland. It was unclear to me whether he had read the script, but at the time he was definitely interested in doing network television. This was obviously considered an essential get. If we got Donald Sutherland, our chances of having our pilot picked up increased dramatically. A phone call was scheduled for the next day. This all happened super fast. And the expectation was that I would somehow nab him, like it was up to me. I had no idea what I was supposed to say to him, and as it turned out, I barely got to speak to him at all. He was way more interested in talking to Matt, specifically about what kind of lenses Matt planned to use. Mr. Sutherland felt very strongly that certain lenses loved him while others didn't. Whatever Matt said reassured him. They spoke about cameras, compositions, and lighting for about 15 minutes, and then Donald had something else he had to go do, and that was it. We never heard from him again. Angus McFadden was a somewhat late entry into the running for the role of Alva Keel. By then, I had gotten over my desire to cast somebody unexpected, someone with a real-world, blue-collar vibe, someone who you would never think believed in the supernatural. This was a holdover from my wish that somebody like Harvey Keitel would play Alexander Leak in the Mothman Prophecies. Instead, they went with Alan Bates, who was brilliant. And here, too, Donald Sutherland notwithstanding, we were leaning toward Brits. There's just something about a British accent that says to Americans, this dude knows his way around a haunted house. I'm not saying I had it up to here with British accents at this moment in my life, but still. Angus seemed to know much better than me what the network wanted from him, and he delivered it in spades. They loved him instantly, and he shot to the top of the list. As he auditioned, I mirrored Matt. We both brought our hands up and did a little tunnel, and goddamn if Angus wasn't riveting in close-up. By the end of February, we had our two leads nailed down. Skeet happily and easily walked away with the role of Paul, and Angus did the same with Alva Keel. Next, we looked at the role of Father Bellamy. Now, this was Paul's mentor at the diocese, the man who basically raised him at St. Jerome's Orphanage in Boston, where Paul grew up. diversity was not a big priority for networks in 2002, but they did feel that we could and should consider making the character, quote-unquote, Latin. Since, you know, there's a lot of Catholics in Latin America, and the Mass was said in Latin, and you get the picture. I remember saying, hey, it'd be great to, you know, get somebody like, someone like Hector Elizondo. And then Megan said, how about Hector Elizondo? And I kind of laughed and said, well, we're never going to actually get Hector Elizondo. And then a week later, we had Hector Elizondo. Dreams were coming true. Offhand comments were becoming physical realities. Miracles began to feel like more than the title of the show. It was a description of the whole damn process. I remember being on set one day watching Skeet do a particularly tense scene. It's where he comes into conflict with the Monsignor and eventually quits the church. I pulled Matt aside and said, this is a big scene. Paul is supposed to be furious. I mean, he actually quits the church. And I'm standing here 10 feet away from Skeet and I can't hear a word he's saying. Matt handed me a pair of headphones. No, Matt, you're missing my point. He should be screaming at this guy. You know, like Kolchak would scream at Vincenzo. Matt just smiled calmly and said not to worry. But I did worry. This just felt so underplayed. Like we were missing the whole emotion of the scene. A few weeks later, when I saw a cut of the whole episode, I was stunned at the power of Skeet's performance. Somehow, the quieter he got, the stronger he got. This was a huge lesson for me. Sometimes it feels like an actor is doing nothing, like literally nothing. But again, through a hand tunnel, they're doing a lot. There were so many moments like this when Matt calmly explained the process of filmmaking to me, because up until now, I'd only been allowed to participate in the first part, the writing. Now I was getting to do all of it. It was like USC Film School, only real. It had been 15 years since we suffered and struggled through our classes, Cinema 290, 310, and 480, hauling temperamental antiquated equipment around town, shooting all night, freezing cold, hungry all the time, driving home tired, never enough time or film or people to help. And now, here we were with everything. Hundreds of people being paid to do their part in bringing this all to life. Most of all, we had made it. We were doing the thing we had dreamed about in film school, the thing that seemed so impossible and out of reach. And yet here we were, doing it together. In a season of real pain and loneliness and fear for me, here was proof that good things can still happen. And the fact that it was happening with my best friend, it filled my heart with gratitude. Maybe things were turning around. Maybe things were going to be okay. Maybe miracles don't only happen to the holy. From Miracles by D. Scott Rogo, quote, secular examples of the miraculous are not unheard of. A case was reported from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on August 6, 1945, the day the United States dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima. Mr. Alan Demetrius excitedly told the local press that a bronze statue of a young Japanese maiden in his home had begun to cry. It was like she was weeping about the bombing. The tears were running down her face, he said. Several of Demetrius's neighbors also observed this bizarre episode. Everything came crashing down on Wednesday, May 8th, 2002. The pilot had been completed, and it was brilliant, a true work of art. In therapy that morning, I had no trouble praising it, and Matt and Skeet and Angus and everyone else. But still, it was excruciating for me to admit, to say out loud, how deeply and desperately I wanted this show to happen. It was, of course, entirely out of my hands. We'd spent a year working on it. It was turned in. There was nothing we could do now but wait. We had expected to hear something by Friday. This was the hardest time. This was the time I would typically go into self-preservation mode. Don't dwell on the outcome you want. Don't hope too hard. It will only make the disappointment worse when it doesn't happen. There was a tremendous, frightening amount of vulnerability attached to all of this. Somehow, this pilot had risen in my heart to the level of Mothman and beyond. Because I had been involved in every stage of its evolution, this felt more like a product born from my soul than anything I'd ever done. Admitting to myself and the world that I wanted this was like stripping naked in public and saying, please, somebody, be super into this. Anyway, I finally said it. I want this show to happen. I want people to see it. And I want them to see me. My therapist smiled and said, how about that? You took something you care about to school. After my session, I walked back to my car. My cell phone showed that I had received one voicemail message. I sat down and listened. It was my agent. He said that Michael Eisner, the head of ABC Disney, had walked out on the screening of my pilot after 10 minutes and announced, this show will never be on my network. I screamed. Then I called my lawyer. He confirmed what I'd heard. Michael Eisner and Bob Iger had hated the priest thing, and in any case, felt it was too dark. Miracles was dead. What does D. Scott Rogo have to say about miraculous healings? After all, that is what my pilot was ultimately about, a sick young boy who could cure anyone but himself. As it turns out, there are many stories of miraculous healings, many associated with the waters at Lourdes in France. And there's one story in the book Miracles that Rogo relates that feels particularly apt. In 1903, Marie Ferrand traveled by train to Lourdes seeking a miraculous cure. She was accompanied by her physician, Dr. Alexis Larocque, and he had deep misgivings about the journey. Marie was dying. Of this, there was no doubt. Dr. Larocque, in fact, would not have been surprised if she had died at any moment. Her young body was simultaneously emaciated and bloated with tubercular peritonitis. She was a mass of cancerous tumors and diseased tissue. She should not have been traveling anywhere. Both her parents had died of a similar cancer, and the hospital had given up any hope of treatment or cure. The trip to Lourdes was Marie's last hope, and even Dr. Larocque realized it might be the only thing keeping her alive. When they finally arrived in Lourdes, Larocque encountered a friend of his, a physician colleague who actually believed in the possibility of miraculous cures and claimed to have witnessed one himself. Larocque found himself becoming enraged, and the two men argued. When his friend asked what for Larocque would constitute a miracle cure, Larocque said, I would have to see an organic disease cured, a leg growing back after amputation, a cancer disappearing, a congenital dislocation suddenly vanishing. If such things could be scientifically observed, they would mean the collapse of all the laws that we now accept, and then and there, it would be permissible to admit to the intervention of a supernatural process. By the following day, Marie was even worse, and there was a debate as to whether she was even well enough to visit the pools at Lourdes at all. The mother superior of the hospital finally intervened. She said, "The girl has nothing to lose. It makes little difference whether she dies today or tomorrow. It would be cruel to deprive her of the supreme happiness of being taken to the grotto, though I fear she may never live to reach it." But reach it she did later that day, though she was too ill to be placed in the pool. So instead, handfuls of water were carried to her and sprinkled across her withered body. Within moments, the blanket covering her bloated abdomen seemed to be sinking. When Larocque investigated, he discovered that her body was returning to normal. Her heartbeats stabilized, and she began to speak. Soon she was sitting up and began to move around, and after a few days, her body was totally and inexplicably cured. Her sores, lumps, and pockets of fluid and tumors all vanished. There was no sign of tuberculosis or cancer. She had been brought back from the brink of death, and Larock had seen the very miracle he had demanded the previous day. There is no Dr. Alexis Larock. In fact, it's a simple pseudonym for the Nobel Prize-winning physician Alexis Carrel, which is Larock spelled backwards. See, I'm not the only one who does it. And for the record, Marie Ferrand's real name is Marie Bailey. But the event happened, and it had a huge impact on the skeptical young doctor, and it affected the rest of his life and career. His work and research centered on pioneering techniques in blood transfusions and organ transplantation. And while he was always guided by the principles of science, his own experience forced him to accept the possible existence of the miraculous. In 1912, he won the Nobel Prize for Medicine. But his true goal in life was far more radical. Quote, "With what I have learned and with what I've experienced, I believe I shall succeed in establishing scientifically certain objective relationships between the spiritual and the natural, and thereby show the truth of the beneficence of Christianity." In other words, he knew something to be true, and he wanted to show it to the world. But his own health was rapidly deteriorating. He prayed, literally prayed, for, quote, another 10 years to complete his work and realize his dream. But this was denied him, and he died without ever proving his central belief. The story of Marie Ferrand and Dr. Larock was found among his personal papers 6 years after he died. I drove to the Disney lot and headed straight for the Spyglass offices in the animation building, trying not to crash, trying not to go to pieces. As I entered the building, Megan appeared at the end of the hall and started walking toward me. Thank God she was here. I choked up, fighting back tears. We met each other in the middle of the hallway, and I reached out for her, when suddenly she grabbed me by my shirt and slammed me against the wall. "Oh, no, you don't," she said. "You get your shit together right now, mister. What you heard is a rumor. There has been no official decision yet. And until we're officially dead, we're still alive. Now snap out of it, because there's a lot of people who worked on this pilot who are going to be checking in with you and seeing what our status is. And you can't be staggering around the lot crying like a baby. Do you understand me?" She said all this fast, 4 inches from my face. "Okay, okay, okay," I said, because in that moment, I was afraid of her. But I was also so grateful for her knowledge and confidence and strength. I desperately wanted to believe her. She'd never been wrong before. So I grabbed that small ember of hope, and I held onto it with my entire soul. Then I started to get mad. I felt like Michael Eisner and beneath him, Bob Iger, were rejecting something that was undeniably great for fatuous reasons. This was back when I thought that pilots were selected on quality. Whichever ones came out best, won. I didn't understand that there were other reasons, far more important reasons, at least as far as the network bigwigs were concerned, that certain pilots were picked over others. When the network people looked at pilots and decided which shows to order, they were making strategic decisions. Which of these shows will help us beef up our sagging Thursday night? Or fill that hole we have on Sunday at 9 p.m.? When we ordered these pilots 5 months ago, we didn't realize that now we'd need more female-driven shows, or more doctor shows, or fewer doctor shows. There were a lot of factors that existed far above my pay grade, and guys like Eisner and Iger knew all those factors and were experts at understanding what was needed and what would work on their network, right? Well, not really. If they were, every network would only have hit shows. So even taking into account what their jobs were supposed to be, it didn't change the fact that those two assholes walked out on my pilot. And you know what? Not just my pilot. Matt's pilot, Skeet, and Angus's pilot, the pilot that hundreds of people poured their blood into. I was gutted and outraged. I was fucking furious. From Miracles by D. Scott Rogo. Quote, "Now we come to the third theme that has been emphasized in this book. If we accept that an individual human mind can indeed produce miracles, then the psychic capabilities of a whole group of minds acting in consort must be immense. Miracles may potentially occur when large groups of people who share a similar worldview come together. Their combined faith and emotion may somehow become psychokinetically linked to the world around them. Miracles may be the result." The cast and crew screening was held on Thursday night, and it felt like a funeral, a rally, an Irish wake, and a birthday party all rolled into one. I spoke, Matt spoke, Skeet said a few words. There was so much joy and hope in the room. There were only a few of us who knew how close to death we really were. Just after the screening, Megan told me that she had heard that Steve McPherson, the head of Touchstone, had ordered 25 tapes of the pilot with the title taken off. This news was delivered to me like it was top secret. But all it really meant was that the studio was doing testing, and those test scores would be factored into any final decision that got made. Copies of the pilot were also being sent to ABC Publicity and Advertising. Megan explained the importance of this. If this department liked the show, and more important, thought they could sell the show, this could outweigh the personal taste of Michael Eisner and Bob Iger. So, there was still a chance. I went to sleep with a sliver of hope still living in my heart. On Friday, the news got even better. Testing went great, and publicity and advertising were salivating at the prospect of selling a show that was about, quote, "the ultimate battle of good and evil." That wasn't exactly what the show was about, but hey, if that's what gets it on the air, I didn't care if they sold it as a romantic comedy between Skeet Ulrich and Satan. Which isn't a bad idea. The news came, as it often does, while I was at McDonald's. It was Saturday afternoon, May 11th at 4:30. It was Tom Sherman, our network executive. And it was his unenviable job to make all the calls that informed the pilot producers of their fate. I knew that once I flipped open my Nokia, it would only be a matter of seconds before I knew my fate. So I sat down at a table near the play area and let my eyes drift over to my kids, Owen and Spencer, as they went nuts on each other in the ball pit. That's my life. Right there, I thought. It doesn't matter what happens right now because the really important factors in my life are currently hurling disgusting saliva-covered plastic balls at each other and having the time of their lives. I flipped open my phone. "You sitting down?" Tom asked. "Fuck, yeah, I'm sitting down." "Well, stand up. You're a showrunner now." "What?" "Miracles has been picked up for 13 episodes. Now, you're mid-season, we're looking at a January premiere, and there's a lot to talk about in terms of tone and casting the woman who's going to work with the two guys, but that's for later. You fly to New York Monday for upfronts. I'll see you there." A few minutes later, I hung up. "You're a showrunner now." I knew that wasn't exactly true. We'd spent a couple of weeks interviewing experienced TV showrunners, knowing I'd be teamed with someone who knew how to keep all the trains running on time. But still, it didn't matter. I had my answer, and it was the answer I had prayed for. A show that I had created was going to be on network television. It had taken a year to make one episode. In the next 9 months, we'd have to make 12 more. Was that even possible? My friends, At that moment, as I sat in that McDonald's, my heart and soul rising up and floating somewhere over that ball pit where my children played, absolutely anything was possible. Thank you for joining me for Season 1 of Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tawny Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Join me on Monday, September 30th for the premiere of Season 2. In the meantime, make sure to check your podcast feed for updates and some special content coming your way from RHPB. So until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.